Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. I'm your host, Saran, and today's guest is engineer, businesswoman, and author, Purnima Vijayashankar. Did I do that right?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. So, Purnima, do you want to say hi?
Hi, everyone.
There are so many things that we could talk about. You are a founding engineer at Mint. You have this awesome blog, Femgineer, and you recently released a book called How to Transform Your Ideas into Software Products. And when I saw that, I thought, perfect, who better to do that than Purnima? So going back to you being a founding engineer at Mint, which sold to Intuit in 2009 for $170 million, which, you know, is like no big deal. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. How did you end up as a founding engineer there?
Yeah, so I actually had known the founder, Aaron Patzer. We went to college together at Duke. And when Aaron originally came up with the idea for Mint, he was like, oh, I have this concept for a software product that helps people with their finances. And, you know, at the time he was calling it something really silly like money intelligence. And I thought,
oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, it seems like a great application and definitely something that's necessary, especially for those of us who are young and budget conscious and like to use technology. And so he started working on it and I got really fascinated by the idea and started to brainstorm with him. And then, you know, I really didn't like the name. And so he kind of challenged me to come up with a better name. And I did. So I came up with Mint. And after that,
That's a great name, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah. And so, you know, right after that, got really invested in the idea. And it was about 9 months, though, after we had first talked about it, that I started working on the actual product.
What does it mean to be a founding engineer versus just a regular founder?
Yeah, so Aaron was the only founder of the company. And that means, you know, you have certain rights and privileges and all of that. And that means, you know, you can sell the company, you can issue stock, and you certainly, not necessarily true, but a lot of times, you know, you own the majority of the company and then you slowly start to give it away to investors and to employees. So the founder controls all of that. They have a board seat. Founding engineer, you know, was just sort of a title that Aaron gave me after... It was actually after the acquisition, and really it was just meant to denote that I had been part of the founding team and, you know, did what I did, which was, you know, build a product, so was an engineer there. So yeah, it was basically the second hire, myself and another engineer, Matt. He was the front end, I was the back end. The two of us got started, and so in the beginning it was just three people on the team, including myself.
So when you think about the founding team, usually there's a co-founder that's very business focused, you know, the CEO money type strategy person. And then there's a CTO, which is more of just the technology and the product and making sure things work. At least in my mind, that's kind of how I see that. As a founding engineer, how much of building the product for you was thinking about business and money and monetization, and how much of it was just, how do we make this feature work?
Yeah, it was. So I think, you know, in the case of Mint, where there's just a single founder, there wasn't really that level of centralization between, you know, Aaron was the CEO, but we didn't really have a CTO. And quickly after we raised a little bit of seed capital, we really started to distribute some of these areas And so we hired, for example, a VP of engineering who came on board and was thinking really deeply about security and scaling. And, I was certainly thinking about features and building. And then about, 3 to 6 months later, we had a lot of marketing people come in. So it wasn't, as centralized as, your question is asking. And that's okay, right? Because it's really not like there's one size fits all approach. But for me in particular, I'd say like my role was definitely a lot of heavy building, a lot of recruiting as well. I was certainly involved in recruiting and onboarding additional talent, additional engineers as they came on board. So I'd say that was where I spent most of my time. I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about monetization or marketing or user acquisition. Those were things I was certainly involved in, but we had other folks on the team that were doing that.
So as a founding engineer, I'm wondering, what was the first thing that you did? He comes to you and he says, I have this awesome idea. I want you to help me build it. What do you do next?
Well, the first thing I did was name the company. That was the first.
Crucial,
definitely. Yeah. The second thing was to actually take the time to learn the technologies. So when I started working at Mint, I had come from a very C++ and Java background, but I had been working in enterprise, meaning I was writing code that, a lot of big companies were using. So this was primarily like chip designers, and that sort of code base isn't in the cloud. We sold licenses. And so the first thing that I had to learn back in 2006, early 2006, was how to get on the web and how to code for a web product. And I also had to learn things like how to code for the web with a database in the cloud as well. And so those were some things that I just had to spend like the first month learning and coming up to speed because I didn't have that background. And I think, most folks, when they're getting started on a product, that's where they need to focus on is learning the technology that is going to help build a product or that the team has already put in place. So for example, Aaron had written a really, really rough prototype on his own for about 6 to 9 months before I joined. And then, Matt and myself just had to take about a month's time to understand how that code base was set up. We understood like the languages, and so we didn't have to sit there and relearn Java and all of that, but we had to understand how he had architected it. We had to understand what the tools were that we were using to manage our database connections, how like the various libraries to manage the front end versus the back end code base. And so it took us a little bit of time just to wrap our heads around that. And then, once that was done, we could start thinking about building the features.
So this was 2006?
Yeah, I would say it was like August, September of 2006.
Okay, so 8 years ago. What was web development like 8 years ago compared to now?
Oh my gosh, it was so hard. It was so hard for so many reasons. So I'll just say like the top three in my mind. So the first reason it was really hard is because, we were using things like Java or C++. Rails like was starting to get interesting, but it really hadn't taken off. There was a community and like Twitter was building at the time, but it really wasn't like people were sort of like, I don't know. So the amount of time that we were spending using, a language like Java or C++, just the amount of code that we had to write, it was not by like, any means, terse. It wasn't the prettiest code. It was like long function names, lots of like configuration. I don't even want to talk about like how many hours a day I spent like configuring things, compiling. I mean, it was great to go and, take a coffee break because I was like, oh, this thing has to take 10 minutes to compile. But it was just, it was just frustrating, right? And we didn't know any better. So we're just like, okay, let's deal with it. But just the sheer amount of like code that we had to write plus the amount of configuration is where a lot of the time sync happen. So that was, I think that was one difficulty. The second difficulty, like I mentioned before, is we, you know, once again, things like Heroku and Engine Yard, they were just starting to take off. So we actually had to do a lot of hosting ourselves, which means we had to write our own deploy scripts, which means we had to like manually deploy things, you know, continuous integration and things like that. Once again, just very, very early on, people weren't doing it yet. So that was a manual process. You know, we would stay up till like 3 a.m. deploying code, whereas today it's like a push button operation, right? So that was, I think, the second challenge, was just getting the code out the door. The third is the tools that are available to us. And it's as simple as having performance monitoring tools or error handling tools or, you know, like PagerDuty and all these things that we don't have to sit there and spend our time building all this infrastructure. Whereas back then, you know, I could very easily split my time between building features and then building the tools to support those features, and then, you know, writing the scripts to deploy the code that had the infrastructure, you know. So it was like very, very engrossed in the full development. Whereas today, we've got things like New Relic, we've got tools like Status Page IO, and we even have, you know, now things like Browser Stack to help us with testing, whereas before, you know, we had to have a QA team and all this stuff. So I think that's another major shift that's bumped up developer productivity and helps us like focus on building what's most important to the business, which, you know, is mostly the features.
So when you you emailed me a short little video about Femgineer and some of the things that you're working on, and one of the things that you said that stuck out to me was that learning to code isn't enough. And I wanted to know, if learning to code isn't enough, what else is there? What are some other skills that people should focus on when it comes to building a product?
Yeah, I think, you know, too often, and I wrote this post December 31st of last year, called, you know, stop telling people that they just need to know how to code, but in particular, you know, stop telling women this. And the reason is because, you know, it's very, very much a habit for people to, you know, especially managers or business founders or whoever, to like just push like build this feature. This is important. This is going to help the bottom line. And what ends up happening is that engineer, you know, who's tasked, ends up taking the list of stuff and just sitting there and building everything to the point where they either burn out or builds into the point where they're reinventing the wheel. Or doesn't really take the time to, you know, use off-the-shelf components. So part of what I like to mention is it's not enough to learn how to code. You've also got to think about, okay, I'm presented with a problem. How can I best solve this? And by, you know, best solve this, it means, do I sit here and build this in-house? Or do I buy an off-the-shelf component that is perhaps more affordable initially than me sitting here and spending my time writing it? Or is even, you know, better just in getting us off the ground and getting our product to market quickly? So that's sort of the first thing, is just understanding how to think about the problem that's presented to you and making trade-offs. And I think that's where I really value my computer science education, because most of the time we were being taught to think critically and not just learn how to write code, right? So I think it's important that engineers understand how to solve problems before they just dive into code. So that's the first. The second is understand process. So once again, you know, just taking what's sort of given to you and saying like, okay, we need to build this feature, and then you start writing code, isn't the best way to go about it, right? There's important pieces like learning how to do test-driven development so that you have the highest quality code base, learning how to work with designers so that you have, you know, key handoff moments, and even learning things like, you know, now we have 2 bugs plus we have this new feature set. Like, what's more important? How can we create workarounds? So I would say a lot of that is understanding how to create a scalable and sustainable development process. So once again, you know, not enough to just know how to code.
Solving problems is really interesting because I think that, you know, the one skill everyone talks about when it comes to learning to code is you have to be a problem solver. But I think that usually when they talk about problems, it's still code related problems. It's, you know, how do you get this button to do what I want it to do? But the problems you're talking about are more user-centric problems. It's more of like, what is the goal of this app? What is the higher level objective? And how are we breaking that down and working towards solving those problems? Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, you obviously want to consider things like, how do I build this button? Or, you know, how do I build this button and make it a certain color or make it a certain width or make it responsive on a, you know, web versus mobile? But at the same time, you know, it's always important to be like, why am I building this button? And yes, do I actually need to build this button, or has this button already been built for me in a way that I can save time and, you know, reuse existing technology? And if it doesn't exist, okay, then I need to think about how do I personally like go about building this, right? Yes. So I think it's important to have that sort of critical thinking skill, because too often that's where a lot of disconnect happens. And like I said before, that's where people feel like, oh my gosh, I'm just a code monkey, or I don't feel like I'm building something that's fulfilling, or even just wasting team cycles in building the wrong thing that customers don't care about, right? So a lot of times it's not even a personal thing. It's more of a business and a company-wide issue. So that's why I think, you know, it's good to have those engineers on staff who can think critically, push back a little, and ask that question, like, why? Why are we building this? Not just, okay, like, give me whatever and I'll get started building it.
Yes, why is such an important question. And it's one that I had to learn to ask myself sooner rather than later. Because what I found is, you know, when I first started coding, I would ask the question why way too late, like when it was really, really hard and I kind of didn't want to build it anymore. And then I'd say, wait, why am I doing this? And then I realized that I didn't need to do that at all. And there was a much easier, simpler way of solving that problem. Understanding process is one that I really like too. I love process. Like, I love a good, you know, way of doing things. But I feel like that's probably one of the harder things to learn if you're learning to code mostly on your own, right? If you don't have a team of designers and engineers and you hope to get that first programming job, but you're not quite there yet. How do you learn about process if you're not yet a developer, you're a code newbie, and you want to get into developing professional products?
So I think process is important even for a team of one. And the reason it's important for a team of one is it enforces discipline and it enforces this like an element of quality, right? So for example, this is a completely side analogy, but when I was writing my book, I had a process, and that process was wake up at 5 or 6 in the morning and just start writing. And yes, it was like total, you know, crap the first version because it was just a rough draft, but it was like, get that out the door and do that daily. And then come back, you know, either a few hours later or a day later or whatever, review it to see what makes sense, what doesn't, you know, can we add a fun story? What can we remove? And then the third piece was show it to somebody else, my editor, and ask her, what do you think? What needs to be improved, right? And that was really the process for how the book evolved as I was writing it. But it was really important because if I didn't have that sort of routine and methodology, then I would have gotten to, you know, the day before I said I was going to launch and not have anything, right? Or I would have missed my own personally inflicted deadline. Or I would just not have a very coherent book. And so I think it's important, even if you are getting started, that you have just a little bit of process. It doesn't have to be so rigid and you can play around with it, but it's really important. And so, for example, you know, bringing it back to coding, I think if you're going to be learning on your own, then taking the time to think about, okay, what sort of process can I put in place so that, hey, I'm writing a little bit of code every day, or I'm checking it in and I'm keeping the quality up, right? Do I want to write tests before I write the code, or do I want to do it after? How do I get myself to learn new things and then immediately apply it, right? So I think even for that team of one, it's important to have some form of process, and it's really just self-discipline And then learning to do that on your own is good because you can talk about it in an interview setting, but then try to figure out, okay, how would I expand this to two people, to three people, to a larger team? So I don't think you have to feel like, oh, well, I'm by myself. This is like can go out the window. I think it's important to still have just a little bit in-house.
So it sounds like even for a team of one, it's not so much about having the right process, whatever that may be, but it's about having the discipline to have a process for yourself and then figuring out what works and what doesn't.
Exactly. And the truth is, whoever tells you like, this is the process and everybody must do it this way is completely wrong. In fact, you need to have a process that's constantly evolving so that you can, you know, one, refine it because you might be doing things that are just totally okay initially, but then as you grow, you know, as your code base evolves, you find that, hey, this isn't sufficient, right? So again, you know, very simple example, when I was writing my book on my own, I had a process where I would just sit there and write it in a Google Doc and then I was done. But then quickly discovered like, hey, there's really no way to keep track of versions between myself and my editor because now I've introduced one other person, right? So we had to change that. We had to come up with a way to keep track of version numbers, keep track of edits, all of that stuff. And same thing applies to code, right? Where once you write for yourself, like that's cool. But then when you have other people coming in and checking in either fixes or additions to your code, you've got to have a process in place to like understand who made what change, why, and then ensure that nothing's broken and that it's still high quality.
So I want to talk a little bit about your book, How to Transform Your Ideas into Software Products, which I'm really, really excited about. And it's great timing for the community because this week we actually had a few topics started around the idea of I have this idea for a side project, I have this idea for a product, but you know, because I'm new to coding, I'm new to product development, I'm not entirely sure where to start. So I want to ask you, where do you start once you have an idea?
That's a great question. So I think the first place that you start is actually more on a personal level. And I think, you know, people, I ran this email course this summer that was for free, and I had about 1,000 people over the 3 months subscribe to it. And it was really funny just, you know, how many times somebody would be like, yeah, I had this idea and I started writing code, and I would have to just stop them and be like, okay, who is this product for? And, you know, why are you building it, right? And oftentimes they just hadn't really taken the time to answer that question. And what was interesting is like the people who hadn't taken the time to answer that question by the end of the course had stopped working on their idea, right? Because they realized, whoa, there's like a lot of stuff here that I need to think about. They jumped into coding and then realized like, I don't really like this. I don't like this idea. I don't like this user. Or it's like maybe user base, or I don't know where I'm going next. So what I always say is like on a personal level, get an understanding of, you know, why is this idea important to you? And can you commit? And I don't mean commit like you've got to build this thing for the next 10 years, but can you commit to, say, devoting an hour a day or an hour a week to working on it? And then beyond that, you know, who is the product for? And not necessarily what does it look like? Because I think too often people are like, oh, should I do this on mobile or should this on web? But instead, like, what is the problem or what is the experience that the product, you know, whatever form it takes, is trying to provide to the user? So I always like to start with just those three basic areas of like, am I committed to this idea, this project, and can I follow through for a while? You know, do I feel like there is a community of people out there, users who will use it? And then, you know, what are the problems sort of around this, the idea space that exists that I can sink my teeth into?
Is there a bad or a wrong reason to want to build a product?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of times people get really judgmental about it. You know, they're like, oh, you have to only build products that are like billion-dollar ideas. And that's like really ridiculous and hard to say.
Yeah, how would you even know that?
You don't, right? Because no one's like a fortune teller or psychic as much as they'd like to believe it. So you don't know. But, you know, even folks, like I get a lot of people who are like, I'm building this for myself because I want to learn how to do mobile development. And I think that's great, right? You don't have to take every idea and turn it into a business. You can get started by just saying, hey, there's this new technology, or I want to learn mobile, and I have like this, you know, idea that I just want to create this little product for myself, or, you know, just a toy project. That's cool. I think people who always go at it from a, oh my gosh, I have to build this into a business, you know, it can be really constraining. And it can be constraining in a way that you lose your enthusiasm for it. And so what I've noticed is this has even happened to me on a personal level for some projects where if I go into it with 100% like business, revenue, like mentality, within 6 months or maybe even like a couple years later, I'll just lose interest because that's all there is to that particular product idea. But if I come at it from sort of a higher mission or a general like interest, or there's, you know, there's a lot of creativity involved, then I'm more likely to stick around. So I always tell people, like, you don't have to, you know, immediately get started. Now, if your desire is to eventually build a business, like if you do have an idea for a product, then what I tell them is like, you can't just rely on your own personal preferences, right? And this is where I see a lot of people say like, oh, well, I'm just going to start building this for myself and then it's going to become a business. And it's not, because you had a particular set of needs that made you build the product a certain way to satisfy them. But now if you want to turn that into a business, if you want to productize and give it to other people, you've got to understand what their needs are. So that's sort of the distinction.
So how do you do that? How do you find out what their needs are and if your idea of their needs is correct?
Well, that's where you start by talking to them, right? So you might have a theory around who this product can help, and then you've got to go out and recruit people who sort of fit the profile of, you know, who you think it applies to. And this is where, you know, again, a lot of people get stuck because they think, oh, well, I've really got to like build something first, put it out there, and then I can talk to people. But you really don't. You know, you can just reach out to people and through a number of channels that exist today and be like, hey, I've got this idea and I want to understand what, you know, problems that you have that are related to this idea, and really just have a conversation first. And get some validation through those conversations rather than diving right into building, thinking that you need to, you know, have something to show. The other reason it's important is, you know, I can't tell you like an exact percentage breakdown, but a lot of the software that gets created is about automating tasks. And that automation requires you to understand what are the tedious or rote tasks that people are performing, right? It's not always the case, but a lot of times it is. And so you have to sit down and talk to people and understand what their general workflows are so that you can translate that back into a product, into a workflow.
So the first business startup book that I read was Lean Startup a couple years ago. And I remember being very, very surprised by how much work you can do before you actually build something, right? Before you actually write a line of code, there's so much stuff that you can research and questions you can answer and information you can gather. So at what point, in your opinion, do you actually start coding?
I think, you know, there's never like a exact moment like, oh, month three, like go, or, oh, you have like 10 paying customers, go, right? It's really up to you. But the way that I like to think about it is I have done a fair number of interviews, and I might even have created some rough form of the product, right? So a couple examples. When I got started with Busy Bee, I had talked to more than a handful of yoga studio owners, and I was giving them just like hey, use this tool or try this process. And it was all to help them get their students to come back, get them to pay on time. And they were just taking my advice. And then they would come back, you know, a week or a month later and be like, oh, yeah, that worked. And it was great. It was good to see that. And so I was like, okay, so if I take what I just told them and put, you know, automate that into a software product, then maybe more people will be interested, right? But I had already sort of come up with a solution to their problem. It just wasn't a particularly elegant one, but it was good enough for them to get the job done. And so I think that's how you want to think about it. I've done the same thing with my lean product development course. You know, initially I was just writing blog posts or talking to people and saying the same thing like over and over again to the point where I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to like automate this somehow. And, you know, over the course of like 5 iterations, I have, you know, taught the course and built the curriculum, and now it's like a self-study product. But it took time to, it took a level of giving that product and refining it in a way that was a bit tedious, but I always had that customer at the end of the day that I was giving it to and getting feedback from. And then at some point decided, okay, like this is enough. I've given this out to like enough customers. There's enough validation here that this needs to become like a product that I can just hand to people, not have to like verbally speak it, not have to teach it in real time and things like that.
So you've worked with a ton of different entrepreneurs and businesses and startups around product development. What's the biggest mistake that people make?
There are probably, I wouldn't say that there's like one big mistake. It's always a series of paper cuts, right? It's always like, oh, we did this, and then we did this, then we did this. So I never think like, oh, there was one mistake and then boom, you know, they were out of business. It's always a trajectory. And by the time, you know, some of them come to me, if they've launched and they're not seeing a lot of traction, then the most common mistake that, you know, causes them to go down that path is they never took the time to talk to their customer, but really they never took the time to identify or even come up with a hypothesis around who their customer could be. And that happens over and over again. Like I see so many folks come to me and say like, oh, I spent $10,000 building this prototype, or I've rebuilt this mobile app 6 times and, you know, we've had 10,000 downloads, but like nobody's coming back, nobody's paying. And when I just ask them that basic question, like, who is this for? You know, they might say something really generic like moms or women, you know, and you're like, okay, can you get a little bit more specific, right? And they just can't. And when they can't, it clearly describes like they don't understand who their user is, and hence their user, you know, like doesn't even understand what the product is. Like it's just kind of a translation. And that's a mistake I see over and over again. People think the mistake is, oh, we didn't build fast enough, or, oh, we don't have a technical co-founder, or, oh, the quality of the product isn't there. But quite frankly, I have seen more than a handful of amazing products where it was such a simple product. Like they outsourced it, or the founder barely knew how to code, taught themselves, and then put it out there and then started making money. And that was enough. But in all those cases where, you know, you would look at it and be like, oh, this is kind of destined to fail because there's no technical co-founder, or they've outsourced their product, or, you know, it's kind of buggy. What you see is those folks always talk to their customers. They always talk to their customers, and they're okay being like, this customer isn't right. We're getting a little bit closer. Or yes, the product isn't perfect, but we're putting it out there and we're going to refine it. And that sort of, you know, I think commitment to iterating and being okay with making some of these smaller mistakes is good. But yeah, time and time again, the ones I see that like close up shop, lose interest, get burned out are the ones who just don't take the time to understand, you know, who they're building this for, but rather just like jump into building.
I think a lot of code newbies get into coding because they want to build something interesting or amazing or, you know, at least popular, right? And sometimes that means they're building for profit and they're building for a startup. And other times it's just, no, I want to build this thing that I think people will like and I would love for millions of people to use it. In your mind, is the product development process different if you're doing it for profit versus just for pleasure or for fun?
You know, that's interesting. I think you put a lot of pressure on yourself when you're just getting started to be like, I'm going to build this and then a million people have to like show up the next day, right? And that's, quite frankly, that's not how products evolve. And if you look at all the popular products today, it's not how they evolved. It's how we think they evolve because of, you know, press and great marketing, but it's not. It's always a 1, 2, 3, sometimes 5-year slog just to get to a point where enough people know about it. And, you know, then you kind of have to backtrack and ask yourself the question, okay, if it's gonna take that long, I want to start off building a small project for myself, or do I want to productize this? And coming back to your question, you know, I think the only difference between a product that's for yourself as a side project versus a product that you're putting out for someone else is you've got to figure out a way to sort of package it up. And if it's for yourself, right, you can put it on your local machine or whatever. But if it's for somebody else, you want to package it up in a way that is appealing to them. It doesn't have to be like 100% bug free or anything, but they've got to have a way to access it. And I think it's as simple as that, right? So you can, you can create like a simple plugin and then have people pull that from your GitHub repo. That can be a product. Or you can, you know, deploy it out to like a Heroku instance and have people sign into it, right? It doesn't really matter. But, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to have some way in which you're distributing it. And I think that's as simple as it gets, right? If you decide that you also want to go down this path and you want to continue to build up your customer base, then you've got to have a way to also track changes so that, you know, people are going to come and give you feedback and you're going to have to figure out, hey, do I want to like iterate on this? Do I want to keep building? And so you've got to figure out, okay, how am I going to maintain this long term? Whereas if it's for yourself, you know, maybe you don't care so much about maintenance or having a regular schedule. So I think, yeah, the only distinction between, you know, for yourself and for others is having just a level of process around packaging it up, maintaining it. The third, which, you know, is totally up to people, is deciding, do you want to price it, right? Do you want to monetize it? And if so, you know, how are you going to get paid? Are people going to download a license? Are they going to pay you monthly? You know, what does that kind of look like? So I would say like those are kind of the three things that you want to think about early on if it's, you know, your product versus a product that you're giving to other people.
There's so much that you've done and you like we could talk about if you wanted to. Are there any other topics that you wanted to bring up and kind of get in there before we go to like rapid fire and shout outs?
Yeah, I would say one thing, which is, you know, it's very daunting to start off and be like, oh my gosh, I have to build this product and it's got to go out there and I got to make lots of money or I have to get lots of users. And that, I think when you put that level of pressure, again, it doesn't always lead to the best results. Like what works better is like, hey, I've got this idea. I'm going to start working on it. I'm going to do some research. I'm going to maybe build even like a really, really rough version or really dirty version of it. And it's not going to be perfect, but I'm just going to put it out there, right? And I think, you know, again and again, I see people who are like, oh, I've built this thing for the last 6 months and they haven't launched. And when I ask them, like, why haven't you launched? They're like, oh, it's not perfect. You know, we're still like ironing out the bugs. And I don't think that's necessary. You know, I joke about this. Like, I spent a fair amount of time like editing and refining my book before I put it out there. And ironically, you know, I took the first book off of the press and like handed it to my boyfriend. And within 5 minutes, he spotted a typo. And I was just mortified. I was like, oh my God, you know, but hey, we had already like approved a 300 print run. And at the end of the day, like it was a really, really tiny typo that no one else has actually pointed out. So we were like, okay, well, I'll just like deal with this and we'll do another run in the future, right? So it didn't stop me from putting it out there. And knowing that, you know, you can ship and it's okay, right? Obviously, you don't want to ship with major security breaches or stuff like that. But, you know, shipping and putting stuff out there, and then this is software at the end of the day, right? So it's iterative. We can keep recreating. We can keep refining. We can throw away stuff. We can end of life stuff. But I think that's really important to get into your overall practice just as a developer or as like a product maker. And you know, somebody mentioned it the other day, which I thought was a great example, is like the Saturday morning pancake. You know, the first one is probably going to be crap. You know, it's not going to turn out well, but you have to make the first one because otherwise you're not going to end up with a stack, right? So kind of thinking about it that way, like, hey, that first pancake is not going to be great, but we got to put it out there. We got to test the grill. And then, you know, we can keep making more after that. So I would leave people with that advice. Like, don't be too critical of what it looks like or how it functions. Just get it out there and know that you can refine over time.
One of my favorite startup quotes is by Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, who said, if you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, then you've launched too late. So I try to keep that in mind. Every time I make something and I'm cringing, I'm like, this is great. This is where it's supposed to be.
Definitely.
Okay, then let's move on to rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Yes.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is...
anything that started with, this is how it has to be, I think, you know, sort of creating these things that are set in stone, because nothing is, right? It's software at the end of the day. So whoever starts off by saying, like, this is how it has to be, or this is how it, like, we've always done it, or this is how you should do it, you know, I think it has always led to bad consequences.
And especially because it changes all the time anyway. So even if that were true, it's probably right for, like, a day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Number two, my first app was about?
It was a coding, it was a genome sequencing. So in my first computer science class, we had to pair up different DNA sequences and I built it in C++.
Wow, that is fancy.
It sounds fancier than it actually is, but yeah, it was quite fun to build.
That's the fanciest first app we've had on the podcast so far.
Oh, okay.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
You're not going to get everything right the first time. And
no, I've been holding on to that promise for like the last year. It hasn't happened yet, but.
Yeah, I think, you know, people sit down and have to learn to debug, have to learn to, you know, write code that's, I mean, not necessarily precise, but, you know, you obviously have to include semicolons where they need to be and things like that. And so learning that it's going to take you a little bit of time to get up to speed and just understand sort of the dynamics behind coding. I wish I had known that rather than like, oh my gosh, I just want to like see the finished product, right? I think too often we sort of jump to that. So yeah, I kind of wish I had known that when I first got started.
And next, let's do some shout outs. You have a couple for us?
Okay, so first shout out is Joel Spolsky's book, Smart and Gets Things Done. This is, I think, a lot of the topics that I talked about early on, right? It's not enough to just know how to code. You really have to think about why it is you're working on, what it is you're working on, and how to be productive as a programmer. So I would highly recommend that. The second book, it's a personal favorite of mine, and for anyone who wants to build products, highly recommend it. It's called The Laws of Simplicity by John Maeda. It's mostly a book on design, but I think it's important for developers to have at least appreciation for design. And the reason I love it is we tend to overcomplicate things as an engineer or think, you know, we can only build a certain set of things because that's what's feasible, but we really need to think more from a design perspective of like, you know, why is this important and how can we build the simplest thing for our end users and delight them. So I really like that. And then yes, I'll plug my book, of course, How to Transform Your Ideas into Software Products.
And that book actually has a couple different like levels too, right? There's a full like course syllabus thing, but then there's also just the book if you want to get that.
Correct. Yes.
So for my shout outs, if you are interested in specifically startups and building a business, Y Combinator is currently teaching a class at Stanford, and all of the material and the videos and the lectures and all that are available online. So I'll give you the link to that. I think I've seen about 6 or 7 of the lectures, and they're really, really good. I really like them. The second, again, if you're interested in Lean Startup, is the book The Lean Startup, which is the first book that I read about business and starting a company and building a product. And what I love about it, it's by Eric Ries, who is an engineer, and he talks about it from having done what Purnima is telling you not to do, which is to just start building right away, and all of these startup lessons he learned the hard way. So if you're interested in that, definitely check out the book. It's a really good starting point for product development and Lean Startup philosophy. And the final one that I have has nothing to do with code and nothing to do with startups, but it's just really cool video. It's called Gravity Visualize, and it's the science teacher who pretty much creates this in-classroom experience where he shows you how gravity works using like marbles and weights and all these things. And it's insane. Like I'm not a science like star geek person, but I love this video. It's absolutely incredible. So you should totally check it out. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, which is our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more on that, as well as show notes on this episode, at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.com. Thank you again, Purnima, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
You're welcome. And yes, goodbye, everyone.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.